You're the ones who painted this place pink? The feds, you know, some psychology thing. The color pink was supposed to keep the animals calm.
How'd that work?
Don't know. They ate it off the bars before we could find out.
Spree is good for Speck or Whitman, but I think Sequence Killer is wrong for someone like Kemper. It feels too cadenced.
Perhaps.
It should feel like a long story, continually updated.
A series of killings.
Serial?
Serial murderer?
Serial killer.
It's better. Let's see if it sticks.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and co-creator and executive producer of The Case Of.
Yeah, I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague. So here we are.
Yes, we are. And here we are at episode 9 of Mindhunter. And just so our listeners know for sure, Mindhunter is a book that was written and published by John Douglas and Mark Olshanker. And they would team up to do a whole bunch of books after that. But this was the first one that they did together. And it was about the beginning of the Behavioral Science Unit. It talks about all the different discoveries that the profilers made when they started interviewing convicted and imprisoned serial killers and serial rapists.
Right. And so those real cases, even though some of you may not have been able to watch this Netflix series, but it is based on some real cases and Jim and Laura have been talking about them. So hopefully, you know, you can still follow along, even though if you haven't even read the book or watched the series. But you can get the book if you go to our website and you can actually order the book there. And then we get a little bit of credit for it. So if you haven't read John Douglas's book, you can get it there.
Definitely worth reading the book. And I think there's so much learning within it. About the cases, but also about the genesis of the unit. Mm-hmm. And what's great about Mindhunter, and we've said it before, is that it is the real cases, and it also shows the human element of the people who work those cases and some of those dilemmas. And so some of that is embedded within the actual show itself. So it does a number of things. And I think David Fincher has, and Charlize Theron and the other directors have done a great job. And certainly there's what's interweaved across all of it is violence against women and girls and misogyny and the cultural nod of where law enforcement was and this pioneering work and certainly where we're trying to get to. So, and there's lots of other books as well. Whoever Fights Monsters and... Roy Hazelwood's book, yep. And there's a great quote, which is Friedrich Nietzsche's quote of he who fights monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster. And if you gaze long enough into an abyss, the abyss also gazes into you. And I remember reading that quote at the start of my career. Mm. I don't know when you first saw that quote, Jim.
Yeah, that was Robert Ressler's book, Into the Abyss. And unfortunately, Robert and Roy both passed away last year. We lost them and Ed Sulzbach, three legendary profilers last year. It was very sad. But they
I certainly
left
knew
a
Roy,
legacy.
Roy Hazelwood and Robert Ressler, and yeah, I was very sad about that when we lost them. And a number of UK profilers and analysts that I've worked with were also linked in with them, and very sad to learn of their passing.
So speaking of the abyss, in this episode, we are going to look into the eyes of an abyss of absolute evil, and we'll get into that in a minute. But at the start of the episode, if it's okay if I jump in, guys?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a cold open, and it's been in several of these episodes, this cold open of this mysterious figure.
The
mustache, yeah, security man. And a lot of people have figured out who this is supposed to be, but it's just such a terrifying, in its simplicity and fairness, that this guy seems to be getting ready to do a kill.
What's clear in this particular episode is that he's laying in wait, and he is then very frustrated because the person he's waiting for does not show up. And it really, really upsets him, and he leaves after, you know, sort of really having a little tantrum. And, well, I'm sure that's not going to bode well for the people he runs into in the future.
Right. And that's the whole thing, Jim, isn't it? About fantasy and reality. You know, how it plays out when somebody ruminates and fantasizes about something hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of times. And yet when they're in that realistic situation, you know, people don't turn up at the time that they're expected or do the things that are expected. They may be non-compliant. They might be compliant. There's so many variables. Mm-hmm. But it just shows that incongruence at times, that sometimes perpetrators do think it will go exactly to plan, to the dot.
Right. And one of the ways we determine whether, when we see a journal, whether it's fantasy writing or whether it's actual legitimate documentation of things that happened, was to see if it's all perfect, if everything goes exactly the way it was planned, or if there's actually things that go wrong and things that were unexpected and things that turn the person off, because those are more indicators of truth.
Actually, this case, when I went and was seconded to the FBI, to the behavioral analysis units, this was a case that one of the agents talked me through. I think we spent about 6 hours locked in a room whilst he was going through every beat of Dennis Rader and his victims. And of course, the name was a self-given name of BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill. And we will come back to him because I think it's a very interesting case, certainly in terms of the victimology and also about him and the learning points, because it was actually his own narcissism that ended up in, resulted in him actually being caught.
All right.
So as we get into, we start the episode proper at the Dairy Queen.
The Dairy Queen, what are they? Some, do you know? We don't have them in the UK.
Oh,
it's ice cream, is it?
They are the best.
They call it custard. It's kind of smooth,
swirly,
ice cream.
Lovely. You dip it in.
Is that
chocolate.
Key food for when you're on road school again?
So.
If yes. Like working hard,
that great stuff that you get when you're on the road. Yeah.
Yeah. So what they're doing is they're taking a little break before they go and meet the infamous, famous murderer Richard Speck. And you can see in this scene that Holden, he's got the clippings from all the news about Richard. He's talking like a fanboy. He's like in awe. Yeah. He says it's like meeting a movie star. And you know, ironically enough, this is exactly what we're trying to not do on our podcast, is sort of lift them and put them on a pedestal. But
that's another thing that we didn't do in the behavioral analysis unit or the behavioral science unit. The offenders became footnotes in the cases because they were the last part of the case. What we actually did whenever we worked the case was learn about victimology first. And those victims were in the forefront of our minds. That's what motivated us. And we did not have sort of fanboy bullshit. But what he was saying was when he was a kid, he cut these articles out.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a distinction.
Sure.
As
sure.
opposed to as a profiler doing this. But
yeah.
Even so, it's distasteful.
Yeah, yeah. And Bill's kind of nonplussed by it. He doesn't give a shit about that. But I would imagine that it seems like, I'm sure, don't FBI agents, don't they get very kind of obsessed and passionate about some of these? I mean,
sure, obsessed and passionate, but not in terms of looking up to them. They're disgusted by them. They're very much trying to wipe them off the face of the earth. They want to prevent this from happening. They want to be able to catch them and put them away so they don't get to do these things. So it's a little bit weird that, you know, although I will say that there have been some very infamous killers that profilers scrambled to go interview because they knew these guys were very, very notorious and famous and infamous. And there was a little sort of infighting to see who would get to interview some of the, you know, the big five or six serial killers from this country.
Okay. So as they go, I just want to point out that, so this is Fincher, he's helming this episode. This entrance to the prison is different than any of the previous penitentiaries that we've seen. The prison almost looks like a gothic castle. The music is different. It's way more evocative. The lighting is different. Everything is different right at the jump in this episode. Sorry. The texture, the lighting. Once they enter this prison, it's like they're in the bottom of an aquarium. There's lots of blues and greens and all this stuff. And of course, I'm geeking out about that. Anyway.
Well,
you really are, Lisa. Yeah, you're very into the detail of it, which is great. I mean, it's good to hear some of that.
But I tell you, every time I went in to interview an offender in prison as part of the behavioral analysis unit, it always scared the hell out of me because you have to turn in your badge and your gun. Mm. You're getting locked into the same place that all the prisoners are. Mm. they know you're cops just by the way you look and the way you're dressed. And you're at risk. And if something goes wrong, you're locked down with everybody else. So it's a disheartening situation to be locked in, because there are many levels of doors you have to get through to get out, to escape if something goes wrong. And you really feel naked without your badge and your gun there.
Yeah, they show really that exposed. They have to get into, I have never seen this before, and we've shot many times in Criminal Minds at prisons and everything, but they actually enter a cage around carousel that kind of rotates them into the prison, which I thought was a really interesting detail. And they're there to meet Richard Speck, and they go down into the bowels of this penitentiary, and they see his... all the prisoners are kind of going crazy, and they see his cell is getting tossed. And
so let me talk about that.
Yeah.
So prisons have their own culture, and they have a lot of rules. And there are guard rules, and there are prisoner rules. And they're very strictly enforced by both sides. And one of the things that this guard did was he took it upon himself to toss Speck's cell so that when they pulled him out, it would look like just any other time twice a month where they tossed his cell. But what they ended up doing was pissing him off and also setting him up, because everybody saw these two FBI agents walking through the halls, and then they saw Speck disappear, and they put two and two together. And apparently, we'll find out later what happened as a result of that. This guard violated everything that the agents told him to do. In other words, they wanted to do this without ruffling his feathers, without putting him out, you know, without displaying the fact that he was going to be talking to the FBI. And this guard just didn't give a damn. He just did what he wanted to do, and you know, to hell with everybody else.
Do you think they were trying to show sort of a power play of, you know, the prison guard
versus the FBI?
Yeah.
So with great anticipation, we meet Richard Speck. Now, I want to give a shout out to this actor, who's Jack Erdy is playing Speck. Now, this is one of our listeners was asking about the casting process for something like this. So this is a Pittsburgh actor, right? He hasn't done hardly any television. He's done a bunch of films that when they, you know, shoot in Pittsburgh, he probably gets a couple of cherry roles there, but he's really done almost nothing. He's a musician and a theater actor. And this guy looks so much like the real Speck. It's amazing. But more than that, he's got this face that's like a road map of terror or something. He just has this indelible face and these eyes that are like both dead and glistening. I mean, it's just an amazing. And so he self-taped his audition. And shout out to Larae Mayfield, who's the casting director, who out of, I'm sure, hundreds, if not 1,000 submissions, picked this guy and kept bringing him back and bringing him back, and finally, you know, he got the role. I mean, it's a huge deal to get something like this for an actor who's like a local theater actor, and he's amazing at it.
Well, I have to say that one of the best things about this entire series is how they cast the serial killers that were interviewed. I mean, these people are very complicated. They had to be, you know, in some cases very disgusting and do some horrific things and say some horrific things. Mm-hmm. And so that's a difficult role to play, a very demanding and challenging role. And I think they did a superb job in casting in this series.
They did a great job, but it's still hands down, Cameron Britton is just up there as the number one for casting. He plays Edmund Kemper. Oh. I just think, you know, it's not just the disgusting things, it's the softness and the characterization of, you know, and use of his...
All the serial killers are great, and Kemper is just exceptional.
Do you still feel nothing?
That's right.
Maybe it feels good, feeling nothing.
Sure.
Are you sure when you slashed your wrists, you didn't feel bad about those girls?
I told you I didn't do that.
Maybe you weren't feeling bad about the girls. Maybe you're feeling sorry for yourself.
Fuck you, peckerhead!
You know why those cunts died?
Because it just wasn't their fucking night.
So Speck comes in. Holden is at least acting the part of the fanboy, where Bill is trying to, you know, ask questions from this questionnaire. And Speck is just like, basically ignoring them. He's just not going to play.
Not only that, he's outwardly antagonistic. I mean, he hates them. He does not want to. He's belligerent. Right before they go into the room, they're shown pictures of groupies that want to be with him. You know, these women who are drawn to serial killers and actually write them letters and send them naked pictures and ask them to marry them and things like that. It's really a bizarre phenomenon. I just don't know why they do it, but, you know, it's obviously personal issues there. But the fact is that this guy is just really a raunchy person, and, you know, the things he's saying to the guards to try to incite them and to get back at them, and then he transfers that to the FBI agents when they try to interview him. Really a nasty dude.
So when Speck enters, it looks like his hands are cuffed in front of him. So you don't really notice it at first. But when he sits down, he reveals that he's got this little teeny tiny little bird that he has. And it's a huge contrast to this horrible serial killer and bringing, I don't know, I guess the bird had a broken wing and he nursed him back to life.
By feeding him meatloaf in an eyedropper. I was a little, what? Okay. And Holden... he gives an awe for that.
So the minute I saw that bird, have you ever heard of the term Chekhov's gun or Chekhov's pistol?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So a Chekhov's pistol is a term in a script. When something appears, you know something's going to happen. Like if there's a gun on stage, even if it's just used innocuously or somewhere, you know that something is going to happen with that gun. And when I saw the bird, I'm like, okay, this is not good. But okay.
Tweety Pie was going to get it. I think that's, you know, it certainly felt that way from the start, unfortunately.
So while Bill can't get anywhere with Spectre, Holden starts to, you know, play on his vanity and starts to kind of get him talking.
Hey, can you show me your tattoo? I've always wanted to see it. And he said, all right, well, you're going to have to roll back my sleeve, which isn't really the case. But he says, you're going to have to come here then, little boy. Really tries to put Holden down, you know, say you're young. And I think, you know, Agent Ford takes advantage of that opportunity. So he's not as threatening, so he can be gullible and sort of take a very, very bold move and build a rapport.
Right. But then he does something that's... I mean, you've talked about doing this before, but then Holden tries to appeal to him, his baser... instinct, and he throws out the C word and says something, you know, very, very offensive. I don't know if we want to say what the line is. But
no, we don't have to say the line. Okay. I mean, but this is the opposite of being clinical, which his partner was trying to do, and he was getting absolutely nowhere. So Ford just went down to the basis level and communicated on a way that what Speck would believe. And so it actually worked. Speck, you know, thought, hey, you're sicker than me.
Get some bragging, and they get some interesting information out of him that he hadn't planned. Unlike Kemper, he hadn't planned this killing. That he'd planned the rape, but not the killing. Hmm. Is that true? I mean, does that hold water with the real fact?
Yeah, I think just based on the behavior that he did not think it through. He didn't know there were going to be 8 women there. He just said they just kept coming home. He thought there was one woman there, and that's what he was basically planning on taking advantage of, and they just kept coming and coming and coming, and he kept killing.
They can't control every variable. That's the thing. Mm. You know, unless you've got someone who's doing a lot of stalking beforehand to understand, you know, exactly who's in the house and what time they come back and doing a lot of surveillance. But that can happen. You know, one thing turns into another. It's the same in any situation, and you cannot control absolutely everything. But I think this scene here, you know, it's a lot. Fincher's trying to do cover a lot of ground around ethics and methodology.
Yeah.
You know, and you've still got Bill with his questionnaire trying to stick to the script. Mm. But again, you know, you cannot control every variable. You've got a guy who's not playing ball and in fact is doing the absolute opposite. And, you know, with Kemper, he was a talker. Well, now you've got somebody who's not. And so they're in a situation that Holden reads he's got to do something different to try and rapport with this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to do that on a number of occasions, whether I'm talking to a terrorist in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or a serial child rapist or a serial murderer, there are times when you have to pretend that you understand them and you agree with them. And that gets them to open up. It's a difficult thing to do. It's disgusting. You feel like, you know, you want to just scrub your entire body afterwards, but it's effective. And that's what we have to do. That's our job.
Yeah. I think it goes back to that line, you know, in the sort of opening sequence of, you know, if you don't understand what crazy looks like, you know, you'll never get out in front of them. I think they use another line of, you know, if you want truffles, then you've got to get in the dirt with the pigs. And, you know, it's the nature of the subject. It's the nature of the beast that if it's seen as unpalatable, well, you're talking about children, you know, women being tortured and murdered. That is unpalatable, right? So it's using different tools and tactics.
Right. So obviously the assistant director at the academy does not believe that you have to get dirty because you're the FBI. And so that conflict just continues to broil. And it's going to, you know, sort of boil over soon.
Right. So before we leave the scene with Speck, you know, Holden keeps starts to push him really to go into, have you ever wondered why you did this? And keeps pushing him and trying to get to admit that he did experience remorse because he tried to kill himself over and over. And he pushes Speck too far and he just throws that bird up and throws him into the fan and kills the bird. And that's it. The interview is over. And
well, I think the point there, and I think it's very well depicted, is the zero empathy. You know, that here you've got somebody who's nurturing and caring for this little bird, so you think there's some hope there because the dark, yes, he's dark, but then he's bringing life. But at the same time, what he's displaying is that complete, you know, polarization. He can go the other way, literally in the blink of an eye.
Right. Doesn't really give a shit at all.
Doesn't give a shit. And he throws, you know, the bird he's been nurturing and loving into the fan. That's a very clear, you know, and shocking to some people. But that's exactly, you know, if you don't feel anything, you can do anything. And that lack of empathy and attunement and attachment, that's very clearly displayed. I think it's a very powerful depiction of it, don't you think, Jim?
Absolutely. Just cold and calculated. And it's an insight into what psychopaths are. They literally look at any other living thing as just the same as a tool, something they can use, and they don't feel anything for them.
Okay, so now here's a key scene. So when they leave the penitentiary, Bill says, you know what, you might want to delete that part of the tape where you used the C word and you really got down in the mud with him because people are not going to understand why you did that. And that's exactly what happens. Holden asks Dudley Do Right to redact that part of it. And
this part mistake.
Of like, there's really, he didn't, this is where the cover-up becomes worse than the infraction. And the cover-up actually starts to become a crime, right? Because if they had just left it and dealt with the blowback, but then it starts to escalate.
Yeah, I don't think there was anything wrong with editing the transcript because, again, that transcript was going to go out to outside agencies. But I do think there was a problem once Dudley Do Right gets dragged in front of OPR and he lies and says they erased that tape. You know, if had he just said, well, yeah, we didn't bring the tape with us, but we can get it, then there would have been nothing wrong. And I hope that any FBIs in that situation would have done that, but not for dramatic purposes in this series. It wasn't going to happen because they wanted to build this continuing conflict here around this tape and OPR, and we will see. It gets a lot worse.
Then there's a tiny little scene where they talk about, they start to define more what makes Speck different from Kemper, and they start to sort of play with these words. Is it a sequence killer? Is it a spree killer? And they're building this vocabulary towards, aha, a serial killer. So it's kind of how you see that process.
Yeah, so they do distinguish between a serial killer and a spree killer. So a spree killer is someone who, in the same continuing incident, kills a number of people at different times and places. Whereas a serial killer kills two or more people in separate events. They're distinguished by time and they're a separate event. It's kind of cool seeing the development of the language that we use, that we have relied on over these years, and some of the things actually have gone out of use. So they actually talked about spree killing, when the fact is that we had a symposium on serial murder in the FBI. We had experts from around the world come together, and during the course of that symposium, we decided to stop using the term spree killer, that there was not enough of a difference in behaviorally of the subjects to warrant that being a separate typology. So they folded that into serial killing, and that's how it is now today. So this historical discussion of that topic was accurate, but once you fast forward to the early 2000s, you're going to find that changed.
Okay, so we can skip ahead, or we can talk a little bit about how Principal Wade's wife comes to visit Holden.
Yeah.
I thought this was an really interesting scene, how they shot it in the hallway.
Right.
Now, in a normal, like in the Criminal Minds, you would open the door and there would be the wife and there would
right.
be an intense scene to shut the door. But this is in a hallway and where she keeps like pressing the button
she
to the elevator.
It was the elevator.
Interesting. I mean, who does? Like,
first of all, that elevator stayed open for a very long time. But
it did.
But I thought it was really well shot. I thought the fact that she kept that distance was deliberate.
Spatial relationship between them,
And then when Holden's girlfriend comes out and she says, do you know what kind of person you're married to? And she said, well, we're not really married or anything. She goes, good, then there's still time. You know, she's really issuing a warning. And I wonder if that comes to roost later on in the series.
Yeah. And these are the real life consequences, I guess, to when you give a recommendation or somebody, you know, takes your advice.
Right. I mean, the fact is that the wife says that he can't work again. You know, nobody will hire him. He's going to other states. He's morose. He doesn't sleep. Well, I would add he's arrogant and selfish. And I would add that he did this to himself.
Yeah.
And I would add that this compulsive behavior that he had with tickling children on their bare feet when he should have been acting as a principal is what's responsible for this. And although Holden, I'm sure, was trying to be nice and didn't throw that in her face, I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I wanted to tell her, look, you understand what he was doing. I warned him to stop it. Mm-hmm. He refused to do it. In fact, he blamed me. But the fact is that what he was doing was wrong. He has a problem. It should be addressed. And he didn't do it. So his arrogance is why you're standing here blaming me.
Can't get over the young girls.
Every afternoon he watches Lisa get off the bus. She's got a sunny disposition. Maybe she even talks to him. He sees her in her majorette outfit, makes her look a little older than 12, and he's able to justify his attraction to her. Maybe even fantasize that she would enjoy having sex with him. But once he's assaulted her, she is terrified. She's in pain. She's crying.
Not fun. Fantasy's over.
He realizes to get away with it, he has to kill her. Has her get dressed. He'll let her go. Then when she turns around, he strangles her.
But it's harder than he thought. He can't finish.
So he picks up a rock. After that, perhaps shocked at what he's done or ashamed, he puts the coat over her head.
Okay, so we're back at Quantico, and a fax comes in from law enforcement in Georgia that a 12-year-old girl has been murdered. She's blunt force trauma, strangled, and they're asked to help out in this case. So it's like, it seems like it's the first time people have actually reached out to them to come on down and do a victimology, do a profile on the killer.
Right. So this is, it may or may not be accurate in terms of the timing of it. I mean, actually, Douglas and the other profilers were actually teaching at the FBI Academy and the FBI National Academy, the first being to new agents and the latter being to seasoned law enforcement officers that come into the FBI Academy for 10 weeks of training, advanced training, like a master's degree in criminology and so forth. And they would get cases that way all the time. So cops would tell them about cases that they were having difficulty solving. So I think that's how most of the cases came in, but did one or two trickle in when the word got out that they were doing this? Probably, but maybe this is a little early for that actually to happen in terms of the timing of it in this series.
Okay, so the team goes down to Georgia. There's this great scene where they're talking to local Georgia law enforcement, and they're outside the victim's house, and they're kind of looking around, and there's a patter that Holden and Bill do where they're kind of narrating, and they're kind of looking around and saying, okay, but there's the trees, blah, blah. And it's just this gorgeous, it's like a dance between them that they have this dialogue. It's almost finishing each other's sentences, and the cop's looking at them going, oh my God, this is a totally different way of solving this crime, you know?
Right, and so it's all about how the victim behaved and then who would have access to that victim. And then he falls upon the discovery that, wait a minute, these tree limbs were trimmed back very recently. You could see that they were raw. Maybe somebody who was doing that saw the child and took advantage of that situation. I mean, we're always looking for construction sites, carnivals. Those are notorious for having people who don't want to be found they're running for something. You know, anything that's sort of itinerant or traveling or not a well-grounded profession, you're going to look at those people as opportunities to have invaded this space and taken advantage of the child. One of the key aspects to the crime scene in this case is that this child, she was 12 years old, she was strangled and then her head was bashed in by a big rock. And then her head was covered up with her majorette jacket, which is a bright yellow jacket. And she was left in an area that is frequented by people. It's sort of a lover's lane. So she was not hidden at all, but her face was covered up. And that is an aspect that we see them develop of undoing, remorse, shame, objectification, all these things that we will use in the future of profiling to actually determine what the offender was thinking at the time of the offense. And so in this particular case, it indicated some shame or remorse, and it also further indicated that this offender did not think all the way through this crime. He did not actually plan on killing this girl, but he did plan on raping her. And it didn't go as he thought it would. Neither the rape nor the killing. Because what ended up happening was he found it harder than he thought to strangle her. And so he used a rock instead.
And that again is
a terrible thing.
Yeah, terrible, terrible case. And again, it just shows and highlights just every little nuance detail is so important when analysing a crime scene. And I think the fact, depending on the timeline, Jim, you know well that when you start doing something new in law enforcement, and you know if it starts to pique interest or people think it works, it's very the intelligence spreads very quickly in terms of people bringing you in to, you know, whether it's lecturing or, you know, and from these interviews, you know, they've clearly been gathering intelligence and information that becomes actionable because they're using it out at the scene. And so your nod to the patter between them is the sum of their learning through those interviews about identifying key things that, you know, the other officer that they're with hasn't got the same lens. And so he cannot understand half those conversations. So, you know, undoing, Jim and I have spoken about in numerous cases, but trying to understand, you know, the fantasy and reality that do not play out. They are always polars apart because you cannot control every aspect and you cannot control your environment. So these little details, which Jim gave a nod to right at the start, the nuance, detail, the context, and that's why you always have lots and lots of questions, you know, when you're going out about the victimology, about the crime scene, about what's surrounding it, about, you know, the environment. There's just so many aspects that you try and dig into. But of course, this is the very start point of them trying to use the information they've garnered from those interviews for it to make sense out in the field and make that intelligence actionable. I think that's a very clear, you know, nod to it here of the genesis and now it moving into the operational sphere.
So as this episode ends with Dudley Do-Right mailing off the tape.
Right. So, yeah, it Speck now has made an official complaint that they were messing around with him when Bill and Holden went to interview him, and so they kind of have to do kind of a investigation into, I guess, with what is it called?
OPR. OPR, so yeah. Office of Professional Responsibility. They're the ones that police FBI agents and their behavior. And it's a very serious thing. And unfortunately, it's something that it's the bane of the existence of any FBI agent that goes under an OPR investigation. And obviously, they didn't get good advice when they started this process. But the fact is that Speck says that by coming to interview him, they exposed him to a beating. And actually, the fact is that the FBI had nothing to do with the exposure. It was the prison guard who orchestrated all that, and they had no control over it. So if they had only just relied on that and not worried about the content of the interview, everything would have been fine, mm-hmm. right?
Right. And for some reason, Agent Dudley Do-Right lies when he really doesn't have to. He lies right. And says that the tape of the transcript was
erased,
which is kind of a unforced error, it seems
It is. And the way this plays out, I mean, it's just he's just such a wishy-washy back and forth, you know, character. Why would he do that and then flip later on? I don't know.
I know.
Anyway, it was a foolish move. He shouldn't have done that. He was not told to do that, but he did it. He thought he was protecting the research they were doing, and they should have just explained, look, you have to understand something. We did a transcript that's going to be published outside the Bureau. We have the tape, and it has other things that are not in the transcript, because that doesn't need to go out to the people outside, but you can listen to it. All they had to do was that.
Yeah, right.
That would have been the right thing to do. But it was not done. Right. So, you know, it created a situation.
Right. So Wendy figures this all out. She can smell that something's up, and she wants them to all come clean, you know? And
yes.
Everybody else is like, no, let's just sweep it under the rug.
Because OPR will make a mountain out of a molehill. And in fact, I was under an investigation for something for years that eventually they realized I had absolutely nothing to do with what they were saying that I was involved in. Eventually, they just completely cleared me of it. But it went on for years.
It must be so stressful.
Yeah, you can't get promoted while you're being investigated like that. And you don't know what they're going to come out with. But I felt fairly confident that, you know, the allegations were completely ridiculous. It was actually that it was alleged that I was selling SWAT t-shirts at SWAT training exercises. Of course, I've never been to a SWAT training exercise, and I'd never had a SWAT t-shirt to sell. So it was ridiculous. So I thought I'd walk in there the first day and say, something's like ridiculous here. There's nothing there. And it went on for at least 3 years. 3 years.
God.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah, how much resources put towards that?
Time ridiculous. And money that could be ridiculous. Better spent elsewhere.
But it's because, unfortunately, OPR is used as a tool by management to get people to basically find things wrong. You use it as an advancement tool. If you go into an office and do an OPR investigation and you find that somebody did something wrong and you root it out, well, that's a feather in your cap. If you go in and you don't find anything, it's not really seen as a feather in your cap. So they're hunting for something.
Right. Like lots of departments, they need to justify their existence. I mean, we see that all the time. So we think, okay, this is going to get brushed under the rug. But no, Agent Squeaky, he cannot deal with it. Yeah. And so at the end, he takes the tape and
mails it to OPR.
And sends it
now,
to OPR.
Now, here's the thing. I mean, look, yeah, that's the right thing to do. But you should never have lied about it in the first place. Now it seems like everybody was in on this lie when you actually did it on your own. And then you're the one that screws everybody else by sending it in. Now, if he had just stood up like a man and said, yeah, we have the tape, none of this would have happened. And it's absolutely, I mean, those tapes are made to protect everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's an absolute. You don't destroy tapes, you don't stop tapes, you don't erase tapes. These things are evidence in a criminal investigation. And in this particular case, because there was an allegation based on their interview, that became evidence. and they should have treated it like that. And so in the real world, yeah, that would have been committing a crime.
Right.
And Dudley lying to the OPR is a federal felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. So, goofy move for good old Dudley.
Right. Okay.
But that's the end of the episode, and it's foreboding.
That's right. We end the episode with the Funkadelic song by the Alan Parsons Project, I Wouldn't Want to Be Like You. And off we go.
So that's the end of episode 9. Should we do recommendations? Have you got any, Lisa? Okay, well, I'll kick off with one, because I did see something. It was on a flight when we were going to do the case of Jim C. It's called The Sinner. I don't know if either of you have watched it. With Jessica Biel. Have you seen it, Jim?
I haven't.
Well, Jessica Biel, Bill Pullman are in it. It's 8 episodes long, and it's really a why done it. It sort of starts off, you know, it's with this young couple on the beach. And I don't want to spoil it at all, but it starts off with quite a violent scene where she, Jessica Biel, the young mum, attacks a male very violently, having been for a swim and come back and just behaved completely normally after her swim. And you don't know why.
It's a stranger to her. She has no...
A stranger to her, and she's arrested and she's put before a court, and it's a detective who just keeps asking questions because her behavior is just off. Why she's just saying, yep, she did it. She has no understanding of why she did it, but she did it, and she deserves whatever is going to be thrown at her in terms of her punishment. And he just keeps querying, you know, why is she behaving like this? I think it is very well done. You know, stick with it. Don't give up at the midpoint, because there's some great learning and lessons that come, and there's, you know, the unfolding of it is very interesting. And it was a book, actually, before it was made into an 8-part series. So I believe it's on Netflix now.
Great.
It's definitely worth watching.
Yeah, a lot of our listeners have mentioned it. I just, you know, saw it in dribs and drabs, but it looked really cool.
She's very good in it, Jessica Biel. But so too is Bill Pullman.
Great. I have a recommendation. It's a documentary that I just watched. I was actually given a DVD of it when I was at the when I was speaking at the Male Survivor Conference in Christchurch, New Zealand, at the end of last year. And this is a documentary called "Making Good Men." At the conference, this gentleman spoke. He was a rugby star in New Zealand. They're called the All Blacks, is the name of their team.
It's a rather big team, the All Blacks.
Yeah, it's a very big team.
World champions.
Yes. And it's a story about his life and his growing up and domestic violence. He was beaten very badly. And if you ever see his picture, you'll see that his right ear is all cauliflowered. Mm-hmm. And that came from a beating that his father gave him when he was a child and almost beat him to death. And so this is sort of the story of what happened after that. And he crossed paths with this other guy who was about his age at this Maori high school. And they were both on the rugby team because this new guy who came into the school didn't have to compete or anything, but he had a great name. He was tall. He was very athletic. His father's name was very important. And so he got on the team as soon as he walked into school. And this guy was so angered by it. One day he just walked into a class and grabbed this guy and started throwing him around and beat him mercilessly. And it was a terrible thing. And it caused the other guy to leave the school. Mm-hmm. And it really changed his life in a lot of ways. And we all know this guy because he became a very famous actor in Arrow, and he was also in The Hobbit, and he was in a number of other movies. And this documentary is about them telling their stories and then them coming together and the confrontation and what happened after that. And it was really moving, really unbelievable what both these people went through in their lives. And I know, Laura, you have said this before, people who are hurt can hurt people. And that's definitely what happened in this case. But they can also heal. And I think it's a really incredibly uplifting and important story. and hopefully it's out there and available. It's called Making Good Men.
And this actor's name is Manu?
Yeah.
Manu Bennett? Yes, I've met him before. Yeah, he's a big strapping guy. Yeah. I didn't know that.
And what
about
can
him.
You watch it on, Jim, or where can you watch it?
Well, you may be able to buy the DVD. I know he had DVDs with him, and hopefully it'll be out somewhere. But it's called Making Good Men.
Great. Sounds really interesting, Jim. I'm going to try and find out where I can watch
DVD.
It.
I can let you.
I would love to watch it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is Real Crime Profiles signing out.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.